Hachette Audio presents Killing Mr. Griffin. Written by Lois Duncan. Read by Dennis Holland. To Bill and Carolyn Steinmetz. Chapter 1. It was a wild, windy southwestern spring when the idea of killing Mr. Griffin occurred to them. As she crossed the playing field to reach the school building, Susan McConnell leaned into the wind and cupped her hands around the edges of her glasses to keep the blowing red dust from filling her eyes. Tumbleweeds swept past her like small furry animals, rushing to pile in drifts against the fence that separated the field from the parking lot. The parked cars all had their windows up as though against a rainstorm. In the distance, the rugged Sandia Mountains rose in faint outline, almost obscured by the pinkish haze. "I hate spring," Susan told herself vehemently. "I hate dust and wind. I wish we lived somewhere else. Someday." It was a word she used often. Someday. Someday, she had said at the breakfast table that very morning, "someday I'm going to live in a cabin on the shore of a lake where everything is peaceful and green and the only sound is lapping water." As soon as the words were out, she had longed to snatch them back again. "How are you going to pay the property taxes?" her father had asked in his usual reasonable way. "Lakeshore property doesn't come cheap, you know. Somebody's going to have to finance that lovely green nest of yours." "A rich husband," her brother Craig had shouted, and the twins, who were seven, had broken into jeers and laughter. "Not too soon, I hope," her mother had said, turning from the stove with a frying pan in her hand. "Marry in haste, repent at leisure. That's what my grandmother always said. There's plenty of time for everything." "For being an old maid?" the twin named Kevin had offered, giggling. "Don't be ridiculous," Mrs. McConnell had told him. "Nobody is ever an old maid these days. The term is single person. Now, who wants eggs?" "Someday," Susan had thought, sinking lower in her chair, "someday I am going to move out of this house and away from this family. I'll live all alone in a place where I can read and write and think, and the only time I'll ever come here is for Christmas."
"Are you going to be a single person, Sue?"
the twin named Alex had asked with false innocence, jabbing his brother with his elbow, and Craig had grinned with maddening 12-year-old self-assurance and said,
"You've got to go out on dates before you get married, and Sue hasn't even started that yet."
"All things in good time," Mrs. McConnell had told them mildly, and Mr. McConnell had said, "Speaking of property taxes," and they had been off on another subject. And Susan, with her eyes on her plate, had told herself silently, "Someday, someday." The dust stung the sides of her face, filling her nose and coating her lips. With a whir and a flutter, half a dozen sheets of notebook paper went flying past her like strange white birds released suddenly from the confinement of their cage.
"Grab them!" somebody shouted. "Get them before they go over the fence!"
Susan turned to see David Ruggles running toward her, the slightness and delicacy of his bone structure giving him the framework of a kite. With his blue windbreaker billowing out beneath his arms, the wind seeming to lift and carry him. He sailed by her, grabbing frantically for the escaping papers, and Susan dropped her hands from their protective encasement of her glasses and snatched wildly at the air. The paper she was trying for lurched suddenly to the ground in front of her, and her foot came down upon it, grinding it into the dirt. Susan stooped and snatched it up. "It's torn." The dirty imprint of her shoe was stamped irrevocably in its center.
"I'm sorry."
"It doesn't matter." David shrugged his shoulders and reached to take the paper from her hand. "The rest of it's blown away anyhow. One ripped page isn't going to make any difference. If it's not all there, Griffin won't take any of it."
"Is it a song for Ophelia?"
"Yeah, it's supposed to be, but I'm sure Griffin would have called it something else. I haven't done anything right for him yet."
"Neither have I. I don't think anyone has."
Susan fell into step beside him, her heart lifting suddenly, her depression disappearing. The wind wasn't so bad after all, for it had blown this luck upon her, the unbelievable, undreamed-of event of herself, Susan McConnell, entering the halls of Del Norte High School, side by side with beautiful,
popular David Ruggles, president of the senior class. For the last year of her life, Susan had dreamed about David every night, at least every night in which she could remember having a dream. In some of the dreams, he smiled at her, the open, sweet, heart-clenching smile that belonged to him alone. In others, they sat and talked for hour after hour, sharing with each other private thoughts and longings. Never yet had there been a dream in which they walked shoulder to shoulder into English class, with everyone, even Betsy Klein, turning to stare, to envy, to wonder. When they reached the door to the building, David struggled with it, pulling with all the weight of his slight frame as the wind forced it closed. For a moment it seemed it would be a draw, but in the end David won, and he and Susan staggered into the crowded hallway where numerous other red-faced, wind-torn students laughed, jostled, shoved tangled hair out of their faces, and shouted things like, "So much for my hair," and "Look what the wind just blew in." Susan took off her glasses and wiped the dust from the lenses with the front of her blouse. By the time she put them back on, David had moved away from her. She started to press forward to regain her place beside him, but others had already fallen into it. Mark Kinney, lean, expressionless, cool. Jeff Garrett, big, loud, broad-shouldered.
"Hey, Dave, where were you last night, man?" Jeff asked. "We looked for you after the game."
"I had to miss it, sorry. 3 hours worth of homework."
"Two of them for Griffin's class, I'll bet."
"A lot of good it did me. Whole stupid assignment blew out of my hands on the way in here." They were too far ahead of her now for her to hear them, and Susan accepted defeat. It didn't really matter anyway. Walking into class beside David Ruggles would have been a farce, and everyone would have known it. Another girl might have pulled it off, someone with more sophistication than she, someone used to walking beside attractive boys and chatting gaily and smiling disarmingly. The only attractive boys Susan ever walked beside were named McConnell, and most of the time she hated all three of them.
"Oh, well," she thought wryly, "at least I stepped on his paper. That's more than has ever happened before. Next time we meet, he'll know who I am, the girl with the dirty shoes." Alex's question came back to her. "Are you going to be a single person, Sue?"
"No."
"Yes. Probably."
Wasn't that an appropriate fate for someone like Susan McConnell? Someone with a handsome father and a gorgeous, vivacious mother whose looks had all been poured into three dreadful, handsome, smart-ass little boys? But that was for now. Things did sometimes change. Someday. Someday what? Her boniness would blossom into curves. She would get contact lenses. She, who had been told by not one, not two, but three different doctors that her corneas weren't shaped right to allow her to wear them? Someday she would turn into a heart-stopping beauty overnight? Is that what would happen? Why did she keep trying to fool herself by thinking someday, when the word was actually never? Morosely, Susan let the tide of bodies sweep her on down the hall and to the door of room 117. She paused in the doorway long enough to glance about the room. The boys were there ahead of her, David already in his accustomed seat, three from the back in the fifth row, Jeff blocking the center aisle as he stood by Mark's desk, continuing their conversation. In the seat in front of David, Betsy Klein turned and said something in a low-pitched, conspiratorial manner. David smiled and nodded. Sure that she would be unable to wedge herself past Jeff and too shy to ask him to move, Susan entered the room along the side aisle in order to approach her desk from the opposite direction. She smiled tentatively at two girls in the front of the row, but they were talking to each other and did not seem to notice her, so she let her eyes shift away from them and clung tightly to the smile as though it had not been for them at all, but for some private joke that had come suddenly into her mind. She smiled all the way up the aisle, only letting her face relax when she had slipped into her seat. She glanced up at the wall clock at the front of the room. 9:02. 2 minutes for friends to chatter to each other, while Susan stared at her desktop. Why was it that some people, girls like Betsy, for instance, were noticed and spoken to and appreciated without ever making the slightest effort? It was not all looks, certainly. When you analyzed Betty, she was not really pretty. She had a round, snub-nosed pussycat face and short, muscular cheerleader legs and a sprinkling of freckles. But ask anyone, even the newest of the freshmen, who is that girl over there? And the answer you got would be, that's Betsy Klein. Doesn't everyone know her? The large hand on the wall clock snapped forward with an inaudible click. 1 minute now until class time. Susan opened her purse and rummaged through it, pretending to be looking for something important. It was easier than simply sitting or then trying again with the smile routine. In other classes, it was not quite as difficult. For one thing, she was a straight-A student, and people had questions to ask her about homework. Here, in English literature and composition, there was no such thing as an A student. With all her effort, she was earning B's. Even so, it was more than most of the other students were getting. The mid-semester exam had been a disaster for everyone, and it was rumored that the final was being constructed so that it would be impossible for even the brightest student to pass. Griffin must be lying awake at night, Jeff Garrett had commented yesterday in the cafeteria. He's trying to think of questions that don't have answers. His voice had rung through the room, and everyone had started laughing, knowing whom he was talking about, even if they had missed hearing the name. Susan dug into the open purse and drew out a felt pen, a stick of gum, a dime, and 2 pennies. She examined them with affected interest before letting them fall back again. The hand of the clock moved forward one final click. The bell rang, and Mr. Griffin stepped through the doorway into the classroom, pulling the door shut behind him. The day had officially begun. Never once could Susan recall a morning when Mr. Griffin had not been there standing in front of them at the precise moment the bell stopped ringing. Other teachers might saunter in late, delayed in the teacher's lounge for a last drag on a cigarette or a final swallow of morning coffee. Other teachers might pause in the hall to secure a button or tie a shoestring. Other teachers might sometimes not appear at all, while unorganized substitutes stumbled over their lesson plans and finally gave up and let everybody out early. But Mr. Griffin was always there, as reliable as the bell itself, stiff and straight in a navy blue suit, white shirt, and tie, his dark hair slicked flat against his head, his mouth firm and uncompromising beneath the small, neatly trimmed mustache. His eyes moved steadily up and down the rows, taking a silent roll call as the buzz of conversation dwindled and faded to silence. "Good morning, class," he said. Susan answered automatically, her voice joining the uneasy chorus. "Good morning, Mr. Griffin. Please take out your homework assignments and pass them to the front. Miss Klein, will you collect them, please?" Susan opened her folder and withdrew the sheets of paper on which she had printed the verses she had composed the night before. In the seat behind her, Jeff raised his hand. "Mr. Garrett?"
"I don't have mine finished yet, Mr. Griffin. There was a basketball game last night, and I was one of the starters."
"That must have created a great problem for you, Mr. Garrett."
"I couldn't very well skip the game, could I?" Jeff said. "The team was counting on me. We were playing El Dorado."
"Basketball is indeed an important reason for attending high school," Mr. Griffin said in an expressionless voice. "The ability to drop balls through baskets will serve you well in life. It may keep your wrists limber into old age. Mr. Ruggles, your hand is raised. Do you have a similar disclosure to make?"
"I did the assignment, sir," David said. "It blew out of my notebook. I'll redo it tonight."
"I have never accepted late papers on windy days. Miss Klein?"
"I didn't understand the assignment," Betty said. Her eyes were wide and worried. "How can anybody write a final song for Ophelia when she's already said everything there is to say? All that about Rosemary being for remembrance and everything, nothing happens to her after that except she drowns."
"There are those who might consider suicide an event of some importance in a young woman's life," Mr. Griffin said dryly. "Are there any other comments?" The room was silent. "Then will those of you who were able to find some final words for poor Ophelia please pass them forward?"
At least we don't have to read them aloud, Susan thought in relief. That was a possibility she had not thought about last night when she sat at the desk in her room, letting the words pour from her.
There, caught by the magic of the painful story, she had let herself become Ophelia. Lonely, alienated from the world, sickened with the hopelessness of her love, gazing into the depths of the water that would soon become her grave. Only this morning, as she was leaving the house, had the horrible thought occurred to her, what if he makes us read the songs in class? There was no way that she could have done that. Too much of Susan lay exposed in the neatly printed verses, intermixed with the person of Ophelia. Now she scanned her words again. Where the daisies laugh and blow, where the willow leaves hang down, nonny, nonny, I will go, there to weave my lord a crown. Willow, willow, by the brook, trailing fingers green and long, I will read my lord a book, I will sing my love a song. Though he turn his face away, nonny, nonny, still I sing, ditties of a heart gone gray, and a hand that bears no ring. Water, water, cold and deep. Miss McConnell, have you completed your meditation? Mr. Griffin's voice broke in upon her. I'm sorry. Susan felt her face growing hot with embarrassment. I was just checking the spelling. Hurriedly, she thrust the papers into the hand of the girl in front of her. An excellent idea, but it might have been done before now. As for those who have no paper to turn in, you may consider your grade an F for this assignment. Now, open your books, please, to the first scene in Act 3. But, Mr. Griffin, that's not fair, Jeff burst out. If we miss doing the assignment, we should be allowed to do a makeup. Why is that, Mr. Garrett? Other teachers take late papers, Jeff said. In fact, most teachers don't give assignments at all on game nights. Dolly Luna, what Miss Luna does is no concern of mine. She teaches her class according to her policies, Mr. Griffin told him. My own policy happens to be to teach English literature. If students wish to take part in extracurricular activities, that's fine, but they should be just that, extra. Any student who allows them to interfere with his academic responsibilities must be prepared to accept the consequences. And the consequences are F's, is that it? Jeff's voice was shaking with outrage. Well, there happens to be a lot of us who think there's more to life than trying to outdo Shakespeare. When we do turn stuff in, it comes back so marked up that nobody can read it. Spelling, grammar, punctuation, everything's got to be so freaking perfect. Cool it, Mark Kinney said quietly. He sat slouched in his seat in his usual don't-care position, his odd, heavy-lidded eyes giving him a deceptively sleepy appearance. Jeff sort of overexcited Mr. G, but what he's getting at is that most of us are seniors in this class. We need this credit to graduate. We sure do, Jeff sputtered. By handing F's out wholesale, you may be knocking a bunch of us out of graduation. It's not fair to us, or to our parents, or even to the school. What are they going to do next fall with 20 or so of us all back trying to get one lousy English credit? It's interesting to contemplate, isn't it? Mr. Griffin said mildly. But I'd advise you not to be lulled into a false sense of security by the thought that it can't be done. I am quite capable of holding back anyone I feel has not qualified for a passing grade, a fact which your friend Mr. Kinney can support. His hand slid into his jacket pocket and brought out a small plastic bottle. Without seeming to so much as glance at it, he snapped it open, took out a pill, and popped it into his mouth. Then he recapped the bottle and placed it back in the pocket. Please, open your books to Hamlet, Act 3, Scene 1. We'll now review for a quiz I have scheduled for Monday. You do have your book with you, don't you, Mr. Garrett?
Yes, I do. Sir, Jeff said hoarsely.
The wind continued to blow. Gazing through the window toward the parking lot, Susan could barely make out the rows of cars veiled as they were by swirling dust. Out of this wild, pink world, a bird came flying, half-blinded, carried by the wind, and crashed headlong into the windowpane. Its beak crumpled against the glass, and it seemed to hang there an instant, stunned by the impact, before it dropped like a feather-covered stone to the ground below.
Poor thing, Susan thought. Poor little thing. Poor bird. Poor Ophelia. Poor Susan. She had a sudden, irrational urge to put her head down on the desk and weep for all of them,
for the whole world, for the awful day that was starting so badly and would certainly get no better. From his seat behind her, she heard Jeff Garrett mumble under his breath, "That Griffin's the sort of guy you'd like to kill." Chapter 2. "Well, why don't we then?" Mark asked him.
"Why don't we what?"
"Plan to kill the bastard."
"Plan to kill him? You mean, like, murder?"
Jeff lowered his half-eaten hamburger from his lips without having taken the anticipated bite.
"Man, you've got to be out of your mind."
The moment he heard his own voice speaking the words, he felt like an idiot. Mark had done it again. Mark had always been able to do this to him, set him up, throw out some bait, get a reaction. As long as they had known each other, since back in middle school, Mark had played this game. Even now, at 17, Jeff still found himself falling for it.
"You're kidding,"
he said.
"You think so?"
"Well, aren't you?" He still wasn't quite certain. The times when he knew that Mark was joking, he sometimes wasn't. Here, in the familiar setting of Burger Shack, amid the warmth and noise and the smell of good things frying, the word murder seemed totally ridiculous. Yet, this was Mark.
"Aren't you?"
"Of course he is." Betsy set her Diet Pepsi down on the table with a short, sharp clink. "People don't go around bumping off all their unfavorite teachers. They'd depopulate the school system. You might wish guys like Griffin would drop dead, but that's a lot different from going out and making it happen."
"You'll have to admit it would solve some problems," Mark said. "Jeff's done a great job of lining us up for a mass flunkout. He practically dared Griffin to do it right there in front of everybody."
"I know," Jeff said contritely. "I just lost my temper. That asshole's been on my back all semester. He jumps me for everything. Every paragraph I write ends up looking like it's been slashed with a butcher knife." "It's not just you," Betsy said. "He dishes it out to everybody. I've never had trouble with my other teachers. If it had been Dolly this morning, I'd have told her I hadn't understood the assignment, and she would have explained it real carefully all over again, and..."
"You two have nothing to complain about," Mark said. "I'm the one who got zapped last semester."
"You can say that again," Jeff agreed. "You got it right in the teeth."
"Well, it's not going to happen this time, I can tell you that. I'm taking the stupid course over again because I have to have the English credit to graduate. But a third time? No way."
"Never," Betsy said. "And you shouldn't be doing it this time, either. Your grades were plenty high enough for passing, even without that term paper. It was shitty what he did, making you get up in front of the class and beg to be allowed to retake the course."
"He can flunk you again if he wants to," Jeff said. "He can flunk us all when it comes to that. The principal will back him up, just like he did with you last time. There's not much we can do about it if he decides not to pass us."
"You suggested something when we first came in here," Mark said. "All the time we were ordering, you kept sitting there muttering about how you wanted to kill the guy. Have you changed your mind this fast?"
"Now we're back where we started. You said, 'Why don't we?' And I said, 'You're kidding,' and Bets..."
"Come on," Mark said, getting to his feet. "We can't talk about this here. The walls have ears and all that bit."
"But I'm not through with my drink,"
Betsy objected. "Then stay here. Jeff and I will be out in the car."
"Wait, Mark, I'm coming."
She hurriedly took a gulp and set down the half-full glass.
"Who's paying?"
"Not me," Mark said. "No dough."
"I'll pay," Jeff told them.
His face was hot and his heart was beginning to beat wildly. Was it possible that Mark was really serious?
No, he couldn't be.
To kill somebody? That was just plain crazy.
Still, Mark had that look about him, the one he got when he had some incredible plan in mind.
It wasn't really that his expression changed. Mark had one of those faces that seldom carried any expression at all. It was a lineless face built on a triangle with the skin stretched taut and smooth from the wide cheekbones to the sharply pointed chin. The thing that changed was the eyes. They became very bright and shiny, as though they were made of glass, and the lids slipped down over them as though to conceal the look beneath, an illusion of sleepiness. Jeff had seen that look before, and it always meant something. Now, as they left the burger shack to cross the windy parking lot to Jeff's car, he felt his own excitement rising. What was brewing inside Mark's head? What was coming next?
Okay, he said as soon as they were inside the car with the doors closed against the dust-laden wind. Okay, let's have it. What do you have in mind? And don't tell us you're really hatching a murder plot. Betsy and I won't fall for that.
Griffin would, I bet, Mark said quietly. I bet we could scare the shit out of him. Nobody wants to get killed, and Griffin's no exception.
You mean we could write him a letter and threaten him? Betsy asked doubtfully.
No, we don't want anything on paper. Besides, he'd never take that seriously. He'd think it was some kid prank. To convince him we mean business, we have to do it face to face.
Go to his house and threaten him?
Too risky. He's got a wife, doesn't he? We don't want anybody else walking in on this. No, here's my idea. We kidnap him. We take him up in the mountains someplace, and we really put the screws to him. We show him what it's like, for once, to be the underdog, to get out from the high and mighty position behind a desk and have somebody else controlling things. We make him crawl. How's that for a scene?
There was a moment of silence. Then Betsy said, I don't know. It's intriguing, but it sort of scares me. Kidnapping's a federal offense, isn't it? I mean, we could be arrested.
Not if he doesn't know who we are. Not if he's blindfolded and doesn't know who's got him.
He'd guess, Jeff said. After that deal in class today, who do you think is the first person who'd come into his mind? Me, that's who. And you second.
So he guesses. What difference will that make if he can't prove anything?
Most of the class hates his guts, so there are plenty of possible suspects.
We're going to have witnesses who'll swear we weren't anywhere near when the thing happens.
If there was a mistake, if he did put the finger on us, it wouldn't be the end of the world.
We're minors, aren't we? Not one of us is 18 yet.
We're just a bunch of fun-loving kids playing a joke. Kids do that sort of thing all the time.
You're right, Betsy said thoughtfully. In fact, last year the senior class kidnapped Dolly Luna, didn't they? It was a kidnap breakfast. They set it up with a roommate ahead of time, and she unlocked the door for them, and they came in at dawn and grabbed Dolly in her sleep shirt. They didn't even let her put on a bathrobe and dragged her out to the pancake house. She thought it was a blast.
They didn't threaten to kill her, Jeff said.
If they had, and she'd reported it, would anybody have believed her?
Mark was getting irritated.
Look, if you two are chicken, just say so. There are guys in that class who would give anything for a chance to see Griffin crawl. I can get all the help I want on this without you.
I'm not chicken, Betsy said quickly. I think it's a great idea. I was just worried, sort of, that we might get into some kind of real trouble.
But you're right, of course. Nobody would believe him. It would sound too crazy.
Jeff, are you with us?
I guess so, Jeff said slowly.
That does make sense. I mean, like Bet said earlier, people don't bump off their teachers. He'd sound like a crackpot with a persecution complex, the kind of nut that shouldn't be teaching in the public school system.
He paused.
Are you thinking of getting anybody else into this?
A couple of others, maybe. There's got to be a decoy, somebody who lures him into a place where we can get at him. Somebody he won't suspect of anything, even afterward. And there's got to be somebody to alibi us.
Like who? Jeff asked. Greg and Tony?
Big Mouth Greg? Are you kidding? We don't want him. And Tony's got a police record from that time he got caught hoisting that stereo equipment. No, we want somebody above suspicion. I'd say Dave Ruggles.
Betsy frowned.
He'd never do it. I think he would.
Dave's president of the senior class, Jeff said. He wouldn't go for something like this.
He'll do it, Mark spoke with certainty. I know more about Dave than you do. He likes a challenge.
Well, nobody would suspect him, that's for sure. Betsy still sounded doubtful.
He seems so straight.
So do you, babe. Jeff reached over to ruffle her blonde hair. The all-American girl, head cheerleader, homecoming queen, teacher's pet.
I'm not Griffin's pet.
Betsy moved her head so that her hair slid out from under his fingers. Okay, Mark. I'll take your word on Dave. If you say he'll do it, he probably will. Is he the decoy?
No, Mark said. I don't think he'd go for that. He wouldn't stick his neck out that far. I've got the decoy all picked out. Sue McConnell.
Sue McConnell? Jeff repeated the name blankly. Who's that?
I know, Betsy said. It's that junior who's taking our lit class. The little creep with the glasses?
Oh, Mark, you've got to be kidding. She started to laugh.
I'm not kidding, Mark said. I mean it. She's the one.
Why her?
Well, for one thing, she's a nerd. You know what she got on that mid-semester test? I saw the grade when Griffin handed back the papers. It was a B. Besides that, she doesn't hang out with us. Nobody would ever tie us together. You know what a decoy is, don't you? It lures things into traps by looking innocent.
I wouldn't recognize her if you stuck her in my face, Jeff said. Like you said, she doesn't hang out with us. How do you think you're going to get her to be a part of this?
Dave can do it, Mark said.
Dave? How?
She's got a thing for Dave, Betsy said, nodding. Mark's right about that. It's obvious. She sits in class and stares at him like she was starving and he was a chocolate bar. It's kind of pitiful, really.
I don't know how you can notice stuff like that, Jeff said in bewilderment. I'm in that class, too, and I can't even think who she is. Okay, I'll believe you. She has the hots for Dave. That still doesn't mean she'll be part of a kidnapping. If Griffin's giving her bees, she's not hurting in there. For all we know, she may even like the bastard.
She doesn't, Mark said. She's used to getting A's. She gets back a paper with a B or C on it and crumples it up and dumps it in the trash. She's homely, and she's lonely, and she's one unhappy chick. If Dave will put a little sunshine into her life, she'll give him the moon.
What are you, anyway, some kind of psychologist? Jeff regarded his friend with undisguised awe. How do you know stuff like that?
I watch people. I notice things.
Jeff thought of Mark in class, sitting silent in the seat behind him, regarding everyone and everything from beneath those heavy, half-closed lids, studying faces, analyzing expressions, drinking in details, and storing them away in the iron-gray filing cabinet of his mind.
I guess you must.
He remembered the first time they had met each other. Jeff had been 12 then, big for his age, standing head and shoulders above the others in the seventh-grade classroom. He had felt huge and self-conscious. His voice had already been starting to change. When roll was called, he had answered with a frog-like croak, and the rest of the class had burst into laughter. Even the teacher had smiled, and Jeff had felt the sting of hot tears in his eyes. He had blinked them back, furious at himself, hating all of them. Choking on his own fury, he had wedged himself into the seat behind his desk, wishing he could disappear beneath it. His eyes had shifted sideways, and he had found himself caught by the gaze of the boy in the seat across from him. He was a strange-looking boy, with a face like a fox, and cool, appraising, gray marble eyes. The boy had continued to stare at him without a flicker of anything that looked like honest interest. He had just stared. Jeff had dropped his own eyes. A few minutes later, he had raised them again. The boy was still staring. When lunch period arrived, Jeff had stayed in his seat, pretending to shuffle through papers until the classroom was empty. Then he had gotten up and gone out the door into the hall. The boy had been standing there, waiting for him.
You get mad too easy, he had said, falling into step beside him. You let everything hang out. That's not good.
What's it to you? Jeff had asked angrily. Who the hell are you, anyway? I've never seen you around before.
My name's Mark Kinney. I'm new in town. Moved here to live with my aunt and uncle.
The boy had been a good 6 inches shorter than he, but he walked tall. Jeff had the strange feeling that they were the same height.
You're Jeff Garrett.
How do you know that?
I listened at roll call. I remember names.
The boy's shorter legs had lengthened their stride to keep pace with Jeff's longer ones.
I'm going to do something after school. Something real interesting. Want to come?
What? Jeff asked, interested despite himself.
What are you going to do?
Do you like cats?
Not especially.
Neither do I. I've got a plan. Something I'm going to do with a cat. You coming?
Will it take long? Jeff had asked. I've got a paper route.
Not long.
Okay, I'll come then.
He had looked at the boy more closely now, at the odd, wide-cheeked face, the tight, tan skin, the sparkling gray eyes. There was something almost magnetic about those eyes.
What are you going to do?
You'll see.
Where are you going to do it?
Behind the school. Behind the cafeteria where they keep the garbage cans. I'll meet you there at 3:30.
Okay. Why not?
He did not know why he agreed. He had no real interest in meeting anybody anywhere when school was over. But he had said,
okay.
And he had gone. Now, 5 years later, he heard himself saying again,
okay. Okay, why not?
Good boy, Mark said, and Betsy flashed him a smile of approval. Jeff slid his hand along the back of the seat until it rested behind her head. This time, she did not pull away.
It'll be fun, she said. Like a game. We ought to have something fun to remember from high school. When my dad was in school, do you know what he did? He and a friend of his got a copy of a key to one of the doors of the building, and one night they took a horse out of a farmer's pasture and put it in the girls' restroom. He still talks about it, the way a bunch of girls went in the next morning and came screaming out.
We'll remember this the same way, Mark said. You'll tell your kids about it. Griffin thrashing and crawling, begging us not to hurt him. That'll be something to remember.
He wasn't smiling. Mark seldom smiled. But his face was aglow with a strange luminosity, an inner light that seemed to come through his skin and give it an odd, ethereal radiance. His eyes, what could be seen of them under the drooping lids, had the glint of smoked glass caught in a ray of sunlight. No one would ever have called Mark Kinney handsome, but there were moments when he had a special beauty, something so striking and strange that it stopped the heart and caused those near him to catch their breath. It was a transformation Jeff had come to recognize. He had seen it for the first time back in junior high school, on that day they had met each other, the time that Mark had set fire to the cat.
Chapter 3.
Davy, is that you, dear?
Yes, Graham. Who else?
Aren't you going to come in to see me?
Sure. Just a sec. David finished spreading mustard on a slice of bread, laid a hunk of cheese on it, and doubled it over. Picking up the sandwich with one hand and a glass of milk with the other, he left the kitchen and walked through the small, dark living room into the bedroom beyond. The old lady was in her accustomed place in the armchair by the window, the spot from which she could look directly across into the bedroom window of the house next door. She was wearing her blue-flowered house coat, and her long hair was pulled back and held in place with a blue ribbon, so that it fell, limp and gray, over the slanted shoulders and down the back in the style of a teenage girl.
So, an after-school snack is more important than coming in to say hello to your grandmother?
Not usually, Graham. Today I missed lunch. David crossed the room and leaned over to place a dutiful kiss on the pink, rouged cheek. The skin felt cool and dry to his lips, and so soft that it seemed to sink beneath the pressure of the kiss and lie there, indented.
What have you been doing today?
What do I ever do? Watch the game shows. A lady today from Kansas City had to guess something behind a curtain that cost $5,000.
What do you think it was?
Any clues?
The man, the one who asks the questions, he told her, it runs.
A motorcycle? David guessed.
She thought it was a small car, but it turned out to be a horse. Can you imagine? Did you ever think a horse would be worth that much money? The poor lady didn't get anything except some little consolation prize, like a hairdryer or something. It doesn't seem fair, does it? They kept saying things to make her think it was going to be a car.
Well, that's how it goes, I guess.
But it wasn't fair.
The weak old eyes settled upon David's sandwich.
What is it you have there, Swiss cheese? That does look good.
Would you like me to make you one?
Well, maybe just a half. Your mother went off to work this morning and didn't bother to leave anything fixed for my lunch, only a little bit of tuna. She didn't even leave some Jell-O. I know we have some. I saw the package last night when she brought it home from the store.
I'll make it up. If I do it now, it'll be gelled by dinner.
Make up the green. It's got the most flavor.
The green it is.
He left the bedroom and went back to the kitchen. The remains of the sandwich makings were spread out on the table, and he eyed them carefully, wondering if he had left enough cheese for the promised sandwich. Deciding that he had not, he took some out of his own and replanted it between two fresh slices of bread. He put a pan of water onto the stove to boil and opened the cabinet where his mother stored foodstuff. There were two boxes of Jell-O, cherry and orange.
Good old Mom, he muttered resignedly.
She bought everything but green.
There were times when he wondered if his mother did this sort of thing deliberately, knowing that the old woman liked lime Jell-O and knowing, too, that he would be the one stuck with telling her that it wasn't there. As soon as he allowed such a conjecture to cross his mind, he was swept with guilt. His mother did well to make it to the grocery store at all after a full day typing and answering phones in an office. In her place, another woman would have forgotten the Jell-O completely, or maybe even not have come home at all. There were women who did that, just took off and went when things got too rough for them. He had read an article on that subject only recently. The author had given some surprisingly high number of such cases and had said that runaway wives in America were soon going to equal or exceed the number of runaway husbands. But his mother would not be one of them. Of that he could be sure. To begin with, she wasn't a wife and hadn't been one for over 10 years. On top of that, she was super responsible. Everybody told him that, his aunts, the neighbors, even their minister.
I hope you appreciate your mother, the Reverend Chandler had said one Sunday after services. There aren't many women who would do what she has, taken an invalid mother-in-law into her home to love and care for after being deserted by her own husband. Your mother's a saint, son, and don't you forget it. You're a lucky boy to have the opportunity of growing up in her home.
I know it, sir,
David had assured him. Conscious of his mother standing behind him, knowing without looking that she had heard the minister's words and was pleased by them. When they reached the car, she had been smiling a little, and the harsh lines between her eyes and at the corners of her mouth had softened. At that moment, she had looked startlingly like the girl in the wedding picture that David had found one day in a suitcase in the attic.
"Would you like to stop and pick up some ice cream on the way home?"
she had asked him. The pleasant mood had stayed with her most of the rest of the day.
Davy?
Coming, Graham. I've got your sandwich.
He carried it into her on a plate.
Do you want some milk? No, it curdles in my stomach. That's what happens when you get old. Have you made the Jell-O?
I'm getting ready to now.
Back in the kitchen, he poured the boiling water into a bowl and mixed in the orange gelatin and added ice. He set the bowl in the refrigerator and ran more water into the sink over the breakfast dishes. He squirted in dish soap.
David Ruggles, president of the senior class, king of the sink.
His lips curled wryly. What would everyone at school think if they could see him now playing the maid in a house that didn't even have a dishwasher? David had never overestimated himself. He knew exactly who he was and what he could do with what he had. He knew he was handsome. It was an unusual sort of handsomeness, but it was there, and it worked. He looked exactly like his father. He couldn't remember his father very well, but he knew what he looked like from the wedding picture. His father had been a small man, slightly built, with the most beautiful face in the world. When David looked at himself in the mirror, he saw that face, looking back at him, fine-boned, delicate, perfectly shaped, with gentle eyes and a fine, sensitive mouth. He wondered sometimes what his father had been like as a person with a face like that. He compared the face with his mother's, strong and sensible. And he tried to imagine the two of them together, laughing and joking and holding hands, kissing perhaps. It was impossible. In his mind, his father's face was floating on a cloud, his mother's coming in the door behind a bag of groceries. One was a dream, the other reality. He finished sponging the dishes and ran hot water from the tap straight over them to wash off the suds. His mother didn't like him to do this, as it used up too much hot water, but it was fast and easy. From the back room, his grandmother called,
"Davy, is the Jell-O ready yet?"
"No, Graham, it'll be a couple of hours. I just put it in the fridge." He left the kitchen and went in to pick up the sandwich plate. "Do you need anything else?"
"Yes," the old woman said. "I have to go to the little girl's room."
"Oh, Graham, can't you wait a while?"
"I've been waiting all day."
He knew this was not true. There was no way his grandmother waited all day for something like that. When she was alone in the house, she got up and did whatever it was she had to do. He knew for a fact that she went to the refrigerator and took out the lunch his mother left prepared for her. And there were times when he found things around the house, candy, movie magazines, that must have been purchased down at the corner store. But now, helpless in the flowered bathrobe, she appealed to him.
"I have to go."
"All right, Graham. Okay. Hold on to me." He helped her out of the chair and, slipping one arm around her scrawny body and a hand beneath her elbow, he half-led, half-carried her to the little bathroom that sat between the bedroom and the kitchen. "You okay now?"
"All right, Davy. I'll tell you when I want to go back."
"You do that." His voice was sharp. He caught it and forced a gentler tone.
"You call me, Graham."
That was better. "I'll be right here." He went into the living room, a dark, small room with a musty smell. He had often wondered why it was called a living room, since it seemed to have less life than any other room in the house. The blinds were usually drawn to protect the rug from the morning sun, and they were seldom raised in the afternoon because no one thought to raise them. The couch was covered with a plastic casing. The books and CD player were in his room. The television in the room shared by his mother and grandmother. The only thing alive in the whole living room was the telephone. And it sat silent on its hook so much of the time that it might as well not have existed at all. He sat down next to it and considered dialing a number. Any number, just to hear a voice. But he didn't know anyone's cell numbers, and no one else was sitting around with nothing to do like him. Mark would be out somewhere with Jeff and Betsy, or some of the rest of the group that always trailed around after him. What they did when they went out somewhere was never exactly explicable. Most of the time, they just rode around in Jeff's car, stopping at one place after another, wandering aimlessly about town, honking the horn at friends, and laughing and kidding around. He knew he was welcome to join them. Mark had asked him more than once, and Jeff had also. David had said,
"Thanks, but I've got stuff to do at home,"
and let it go at that. He knew they would never understand his mother's reasoning that there should be a definite, pre-planned activity or time was being wasted.
"Where is it you're going?"
she would ask.
"What is it you're going to do there? Where can I reach you in an emergency?"
It wasn't that she forbade him to go places. It was just that by the time they finished hashing things over, his enthusiasm had usually faded to the point where going was hardly worth the effort.
"Unless there's a reason," his mother said. "A real reason. It's nice for you to be at home in the afternoons. Your grandmother sits there alone all day, you know, and your homecoming at 3 is the high point of her day."
In the evenings, they ate later than most people because his mother wasn't up to facing the kitchen immediately after a day at work. Then there was homework.
"It's important to keep up with your studies," his mother told him. "You're our hope for the future, Davy. Anything good that happens to this family will come through you."
This was true, he knew, and he thought about it often. His mother's salary as a secretary was not going to increase, and there was no place she could move within the ranks of the company for which she worked. Unless she remarried, her life was at a stalemate. And remarriage for her seemed highly unlikely. It wasn't that she was unattractive. At 42, she still looked remarkably good, with a lean, strong figure and hair as dark and thick as David's own. But she had no interest in meeting men or in going out with them.
"One marriage is enough for anybody," she stated firmly.
And then, after a slight pause, she would sometimes add,
"More than enough,"
with a note of bitterness in her voice. So, when David was grown, his mother would be there still, slaving away to make ends meet. And for all he knew, Graham would be there, too. For an invalid, Graham seemed amazingly healthy, scarcely ever coming down with the illnesses other people were prone to. Perhaps it was because, cloistered as she was, she never got exposed to any germs. Anyway, despite her age, She didn't show any indication of leaving her present world for the next one at any time in the near future. When he hit the job market, David figured he could count on two people to support other than himself. For that reason, it was important to have the best educational background possible. His father had gone to Stanford. That, for David, was out of the question, but with a top-notch transcript and high ACT scores, he figured he would definitely be in the running for the special scholarship offered annually by the president of the University of New Mexico to an outstanding and needy student from the Albuquerque area. In the long run, he had his hopes pinned on law school. To this end, he ran for school offices and took part in debating and other speech-oriented activities. Such things looked good on your record if you were aiming for a pre-law program. Now, in his last semester of high school, that record looked good, but since the president's scholarship was not awarded until final grades were out, what concerned him was the upcoming grade in English. He had always considered himself a good English student. He read his assignments faithfully and was meticulous about his essays. Dolly Luna, last year's teacher, formerly she was Miss Luna, but the first day of class she had told them, "Call me Dolly," had given him A's on all his papers, followed by strings of exclamation marks. But the same sort of essays submitted in Mr. Griffin's class brought C's. "Mechanics okay," Griffin had written on one paper. "You have a grasp of grammar and punctuation, but the writing itself is shallow. There's nothing to it. Don't parrot back my lectures. Get under the surface. Tell me something about Hamlet I don't already know." "Something he doesn't know," David had exclaimed in frustration when that paper was returned to him. "He's supposed to be the expert. I'm just a student. If there's stuff about Shakespeare he doesn't know, what's he doing teaching it?" And now, today, those blown-away papers added an F to his grade list, which very likely brought the average down to D. He had done what he could about it, even skipping lunch in order to rewrite the paper, but true to his word, Griffin would not accept it. "I thought I made it clear, Mr. Ruggles," he had said in his cool, crisp voice, "that I do not take late papers, no matter what the excuse for them may be." So that whole hour's work had been for nothing, and unless he could ace the final, which seemed unlikely, he would probably find that D permanently situated on his transcript. "I can see why Mark did what he did last semester," he muttered angrily. "I might be tempted to try the same thing myself if I thought it would do any good." A chime rang out. Startled, David reached for the telephone receiver, stopped, waited. Then he realized it had been the doorbell. "Who on earth?" he thought, getting up and crossing the room. He opened the front door. "Oh, hey, I was just thinking about you."
"You were, huh?"
Mark's lean figure stood slouched in the doorway.
"You got a girl in there or something? Why is it so dark?"
"You know my mom," David said. "She doesn't want the rug to bleach out. You got the gang with you?"
"Jeff and Betsy are out front in Jeff's car." "Want to go cruising? We've got an idea about something we want to talk over with you."
"I can't right now. I've got stuff I'm supposed to be doing here." David was acutely conscious of the old woman in the bathroom only a couple of yards away. Any moment now, her voice might ring out asking to be taken back to her room. Mark knew more about his family life than anyone at school, but details like this were more than he needed to be subjected to.
"I'll walk out to the car with you," David said. "Can't you cue me in on the basics?"
"It'll take more time than that," Mark said. "There's a lot to be worked out. What it boils down to is this. We're out to work over Griffin."
"Work him over?"
"Scare him shitless. Get him crawling. Teach him he can't pull the sort of stuff he pulled today."
"How are you going to do it?"
"We're going to kidnap him," Mark said. "We're going to make him think we're going to kill him."
"Oh, wow," David said, drawing in his breath. "That's heavy stuff, man. You could get into all kinds of trouble."
"I don't think so. Not if he's blindfolded. Not the way I'm working it out."
Mark put a hand on his shoulder.
"How about it, Dave? Want to be a part of it?"
From the dark behind them, a cracked old voice called,
"Davy?"
"Look," David said. "Like I told you, I've got some stuff to do. Later, after dinner, I'm going to the library. I'll meet you then, say around 8, okay? At the Burger Shack?" "Not okay. I need to know now."
Mark's hand remained warm on his shoulder. His voice dropped until it was almost a whisper, so intense that the words came forth in short, painful jabs.
Dave, how can you stand it? Living like this? How long has it been since you did something crazy? Just for the hell of it. How long has it been since you've done something wild? Just for fun?
You're not really planning to hurt him?
Hell no. Just scare him. Shake him up some. Are you with us?
All of David's life rose up behind him in one great gray wave.
Count me in, he said.
Chapter 4. It was the sound of the telephone ringing in the upstairs hallway that woke Susan at 9:30 on Saturday morning. She was always aware of the telephone. It was situated directly outside her bedroom door.
Who can be calling so early?
She thought irritably, squirming over onto her stomach and burrowing her face into her pillow to escape the sunlight that was streaming between the half-drawn curtains and flooding the room with unwelcome brilliance. Saturdays were special to Susan. They meant that she did not have to get up in time to sit through the ordeal of a family breakfast with all the squabbling and spilling and teasing that went with it. She did not have to go to school and smile her way through a morning filled with semi-strangers. She did not have to worry about which cafeteria table to sit at during lunch and whether to tack herself onto the edge of a group that was already eating or sit alone and wait to see if someone sat down beside her. On Saturdays, she could sleep late and get up at last to a house with most of the people already out of it. She could make herself peanut butter toast and read at the table. And after that, she could shut herself back in her bedroom and write. She could spend her whole day there if she wanted to. Unless, of course, her mother dragged her out to do some household chore. The telephone had no right to ring on Saturday mornings. People should tiptoe softly about, not disturbing each other. The boys should tell their friends that if they wanted to see them, they could stand in the yard and toss pebbles at their windows, not bring the house down with the shrillness of a telephone blast.
Why doesn't someone answer it? Susan thought as the phone continued to ring. Are they deaf or all of them out somewhere?
Finally, with a sigh of resignation, she dragged herself out from under the covers and crossed the room to the door. Her hand was on the knob when the ringing stopped. Craig's voice called,
Sue, it's for you.
For me?
Susan turned the knob and stepped out into the hall.
Who is it?
How should I know? Some guy.
Craig's voice was on the edge of changing. Sometimes it came out high and shrill like a little boy's, and the other times it started deep and ended in a creak. Now it was suddenly very low and almost booming.
Don't tell me the single person's got herself a boyfriend.
Oh, hush.
She snatched the receiver from his hand.
Hello?
Hello, Sue,
a masculine voice said.
This is David Ruggles.
It's a joke, Susan thought. It's something Craig and the twins have set up for me.
David who?
She asked, trying to keep her voice steady.
It's Dave Ruggles.
From school?
From your lit class. The one whose papers you were chasing yesterday, remember? Oh, yes. Yes, of course, I know who you are.
It was not a joke then, it was real. Or perhaps she was still in bed asleep and dreaming.
It's such a great day out, the voice on the telephone was saying. With the wind down and everything, a bunch of us thought we'd take a picnic up into the mountains. I was wondering if you might like to go.
You mean today? Are you busy?
No,
Susan said.
I'm not busy at all. I'd like to go.
You would?
Cool. We'll be by for you around 11 then, okay?
Okay,
Susan said. And then, as a frantic afterthought, do you know where I live? The address in the phone book is right, isn't it?
Yes, yes, it's right. Okay, then I'll see you in a little while.
Stunned, she replaced the receiver on the hook. For a moment, she simply stood there, staring at it, at the pale beige plastic instrument that had brought the incredible message.
I have a date!
You're kidding,
Craig exclaimed with astonishment.
That guy really asked you out? To a picnic. Holy cow! Wait till I tell the twins!
With a bellow of laughter, Craig went rocketing down the hall, shouting his piece of news. Susan went back into her room and shut the door.
I have a date with David,
she told herself numbly. She could say the words, but she could not actually believe them. She went into the bathroom and brushed her teeth. The face in the bathroom mirror looked back at her, softly blurred because she was not wearing her glasses. It was a rather narrow face with a high forehead, and it was framed with fine, mouse-colored hair. It was not the face of a girl David Ruggles would ask for a date. Yet, it had happened.
It had happened.
She rinsed out the toothbrush and hung it on the rack and went back into her room and got dressed. Jeans and sandals and a pale blue shirt with some embroidery on the sleeves. She combed her hair and put on her glasses, and the room came into focus.
I have a date with David.
There was a brief, perfunctory knock. The bedroom door opened, and her mother came in.
Craig told me the news, she said. My goodness, Sue, who is this boy? He's the president of the senior class.
How exciting! Her mother's eyes were shining. What are you going to take?
Take?
Craig said it was a picnic.
I didn't think about that.
Susan regarded her mother blankly.
What'll I do? I don't know what other people are bringing. He didn't say anything about the food.
I'll make you some sandwiches, Mrs. McConnell said. We have chicken left over from last night's dinner. And there's still some chocolate cake. At least I think there is, if the boys haven't eaten it. Does that sound all right?
I guess so,
Susan said. The numbness was beginning to wear off now, and she felt the sharp edge of panic rising within her.
Oh, Mom, what if it's awful? I mean, what if I can't think of anything to talk to him about?
Just talk about the same things you talk about at school.
We don't talk in school. He doesn't sit near me in any classes. I talked to him yesterday, just for a minute, about the lit assignment, but that's not the kind of thing you say twice. I mean, we talked about that, and now it's done. You can't keep discussing an assignment.
You'll think of something. That's the sort of thing that takes care of itself. He'll probably have things he wants to talk about. He must like you, honey, or he wouldn't have called.
I have a date with David.
At 11:10, the doorbell rang, and he was there. Handsome and smiling, unselfconsciously shaking hands with her parents, reaching out to take the handle of the picnic basket.
Don't worry, Mrs. McConnell, she'll be safe. Jeff Garrett's driving, and he's really careful.
Even Craig's curious inspection and the snaggletooth leers of the twins didn't appear to faze him. Susan stared at his hands. They were the cleanest hands she had ever seen, long and slender with tapering fingers. She was afraid that if she lifted her eyes and looked him full in the face, she would be blinded as though she were looking straight into the dazzling radiance of the sun.
Have fun,
her mother said.
Don't eat too much, came from her father, who did not seem to understand the significance of what was happening, that his 16-year-old daughter was finally, at long last, about to embark on a first date, and that it was not just any boy who had asked her out, but this particular boy. They crossed the lawn to the car, and David opened the door for her and lifted in the basket.
You know everybody, don't you? Jeff, Mark, Betsy. Hello, Sue. What a cute shirt.
Betsy Klein threw her a warm, bright, welcoming smile.
Hi, Sue,
Mark said, and Jeff said, Great day for a picnic, right? It's almost like summer. And that suddenly, that easily, she felt she was one of them. Her mother had been right. There was no problem with talking, because the rest of them were talking so much themselves. They seemed to know each other well, but not so well that they excluded her from their conversation. With everything that was said, a door was opened deliberately so that she could enter with a comment. They drove out of the city on the freeway and turned off onto the paved road that led to the mountains. And almost immediately the fresh green of the spring trees surrounded them, and the sky arched blue above their heads. Mark opened a six-pack of beer.
If it was Coke, it would look like a TV commercial, he said,
and they all laughed, Susan right along with them. She had never thought of Mark as being funny before. In fact, she had always been a little frightened of him, with his smooth, expressionless face and knowing eyes. But now, suddenly, he wasn't frightening at all, just lighthearted and carefree.
And it was like a TV commercial with a car full of beautiful, laughing young people setting out to spend a day together in the hills. After several miles, Jeff turned again, and this time they were on a dirt road that curved and twisted and doubled back upon itself until it seemed to be going nowhere. At last they came to a clearing, and Jeff stopped the car, and they all got out.
"This is the place," Mark said. "Lana and I used to come up here all the time. You can't see it from here, but there's a path over there by that rock, and it leads to a waterfall."
He began to lead the way, and the rest of them fell into step behind him, walking single file. David carrying the picnic basket, and Jeff with a blanket and a tote bag of food that Betsy had brought. Susan followed along in David's footsteps, his slim, straight back moving directly ahead of her. They walked through the woods, and it was still. There was nothing but the sound of their feet crunching dead branches.
"Who's Lana?"
she asked David in a low voice.
"The girl Mark used to go with until Griffin gave it the axe.
You've heard about that, haven't you? I thought everybody had."
"I haven't."
"Well, I'll tell you later." He tossed her a smile over his shoulder.
"I've dreamed this before," Susan thought.
She wrote about it later and pretended it really happened once when Mr. Griffin wanted a descriptive essay. He said she picked nice adjectives, but marked her down for spelling. They heard the waterfall before they saw it. The closer they got, the louder it became, until they broke through the trees and were upon it, a frothing, tumbling, churning burst of silver that poured itself madly over rocks and then dropped straight down for several feet into the stream below.
"Hey, awesome!" Jeff exclaimed,
and Betsy gave a little squeal of delight.
"I didn't know it was back here."
"Nobody does," Mark told her. "Nobody ever comes here. Lana and I stumbled on it one day when we were out hiking. We came back a lot of times, and we were the only ones."
"Cool, huh?"
David said, smiling at Susan.
"It's simply beautiful."
She felt she should say something more, but the words wouldn't come, and anything she made herself say would be too little or too much.
"Let's eat," Jeff said.
"I hope you brought plenty of food. I'm starving."
"Aren't you always?"
Betsy said with a laugh.
"You guys are all bottomless pits."
They spread the blanket on the ground and ate their lunch on the bank of the stream, on the very edge of the sparkling water. Afterward, they lay stretched out on the blanket and on the grass and talked in an easy, lazy manner as if they had all been friends forever. Mark was leaning against the trunk of a tree, smoking a joint, and the sweet, heavy scent of pot blended with the incense of the sun-soaked pine needles. Betsy was lying on the blanket, her blue-jeaned knees drawn up into little pointed peaks. Her eyes were closed, and she looked totally at peace. Jeff was sprawled next to her on his back. He was dreamily studying the line of a pine branch stretching squarely over his head. Susan took off her glasses and laid them on her stomach, and the world went soft and unfocused around her.
"You look different without your glasses," David said softly. "Your whole face changes. Do you really have to wear them?"
"Only if I want to see," Susan told him, amazed at her sudden ability to answer such a question lightly.
"It helps when you're walking and stuff, you know, so you don't bump into things."
"You look okay with them on," David said.
"It's just that now,
with them off, you look sort of fragile, like you need to be taken care of or something."
"I wonder what Mr. Griffin looks like without his glasses," Betsy said.
She spoke without opening her eyes.
"Fragile? Like he needs to be taken care of?"
"Are you kidding?"
Jeff started to laugh. "We'll have to take them off before we blindfold him. We don't want to shove them straight through his eyeballs."
"Blindfold him?"
Susan thought she had heard him incorrectly.
"Did you say blindfold?"
Suddenly, she realized that the atmosphere had changed. The blurred ovals of their faces were turned toward her, waiting, calculating.
"You heard right,"
Jeff said slowly, and they told her the thing that they were going to do. Later, Susan could not recall exactly which one told her, or whether they all did, each speaking apart, the voices overlapping and running together like the lines and curves of David's face as he raised himself on one elbow and leaned over to touch the tip of her nose lightly with one finger.
You like our idea?
You're kidding me. You're not really going to do it.
Damned right we are.
Well, I don't believe you. It's like something out of a book.
She could accept it when she thought of it that way, as a story, the people in it characters created by an author. She could imagine the words neatly printed on a page. The shadowy figure seized him from behind and forced him into the waiting car. His cries for help brought no response. Where were they taking him? What were they going to do?
It's unreal, she said. You're making it up to tease me.
You can be in on it if you want to.
Me? How? Susan asked.
Mark will tell you. He's doing the planning.
You can make an appointment with him for after school, Mark said. Pretend you want to talk with him about the term paper or something. Hold him till the grounds are empty. Then when he walks out to the parking lot, we'll get him.
You really think it would be that simple?
Sure. Why not?
Mark took a long drag on the joint and let the smoke curl slowly from between his teeth.
The best things in life are simple. Simple things work. They don't get screwed up. It's the complicated things that get twisted around on you.
We'll all have our parts, Betsy said. Mine will be to provide alibis for everybody. The guys are going to blindfold Griffin so he won't be able to see who anybody is. Then afterward, he won't be able to identify anyone.
He'll know me if I make the appointment, Susan said. He won't be blindfolded then.
He won't guess you're part of it, Mark told her easily. It'll just seem like a coincidence. He stays after school to talk with a student. He goes outside, and we're waiting for him by his car. You'll have split before that happens. You won't even be on the scene.
But why? Susan asked. What's the reason for it all? People don't get kidnapped without a reason.
The reason is that he deserves it, Mark said sharply. Does there have to be any other reason than that? He's an asshole. He's out to flunk all of us. Maybe if we shake him up a little, he'll get over this power trip of his and start treating us like human beings.
I don't know, Susan said hesitantly. I've never done anything like this.
Who has? Jeff said. It'll be a first for all of us. We've got to do something really wild once in our lives before we're grown and tied down. Let's get some kicks while we can, and we'll teach old Griffin a lesson at the same time.
When would you want to do it?
What about Thursday? Mark said. That will give us time to get all the details worked out. Besides, he's giving a quiz Monday, which means we'll probably get the papers back Wednesday. That way you could call him Wednesday night and ask him for a conference after school the next day. You could say you want to discuss the test.
Okay, Sue? David asked. Well, come on. Okay.
She heard her voice speaking the word, and her heart rose suddenly into her throat. Had she really said that? Had she actually agreed to this insanity?
Good for you, Jeff said, and Betsy gave a crow of pleasure.
I knew you'd do it, Sue, she said. I told the guys.
That's my girl, David said softly, and he kissed her, lightly, on the forehead. His lips were like the touch of butterfly wings.
Never, Susan thought deliriously, never in all the time to come will I ever, ever be as happy as I am right now.
And she was right.